I said infantry because I didn't really know if I could do it, if I could take it, if it would break me down and chew me up and then continue to keep on chewing. I said infantry because I knew that here was a portion of what work is. Here was a portion of what they fed to the lions and the dust and name of Rome. I said infantry because my great-grandfather Carter was gassed during the Battle of Meuse Argonne in the fall of 1918, the bloodiest battle in American history. He was there in France during the First World War, and yet he still managed to crawl out through the ruined ground, the world rung into a gear-toothed roar, canisters of gas hissing as they flew over, and he made it back home, though the war would drag him under a few short years later. I said infantry because one of my great-greats enlisted in the Union Army at Cumberland Gap, Tennessee, and later served as a corporal in the Tennessee Volunteers. And even though he'd cracked his back on a green horse at Camp Dennison and later contracted rheumatic fever during a bitter December in Knoxville, he stayed on through the fight, from the Confederate horses shot in the river at Shelbyville and on to Huntsville, Alabama, from Bucktown Tavern to Powder Springs to the siege of Atlanta, from the Battle of Franklin, the Battle of Nashville, and the pursuit of General John Bell Hood clear to the Tennessee River. I raised my hand and said the words, "I swear," because I would have been ashamed in the years to come if I hadn't, even if it didn't make sense, even if nobody I cared about ever thought about it, even if all the veterans in my family never said a word, or even if they did, saying, "It's cool, Brian. It doesn't mean a thing. Believe me, the uniform doesn't make the man," or anything along those lines, because it would have meant that between me and the people I revered most, there were beaches and jungle foliage and Russian MiGs and snipers and artillery craters and midnights spent drifting on the Pacific under the Southern Cross. Between me and the people I most revered, there were explosions I couldn't hear, curses and shouting and laughter, engines thrumming, Hueys and Blackhawks lifting from the grass and sand to map the earth in medevac flights that would deliver the wounded to gentle hands and latex gloves, surgeons calling for scalpels and sutures and more blood, type AB negative, while the airmen on the flight line hosed bodily fluids from the decks and drank coffee when the day was done. I signed the paper because I knew that on some deep and immutable level, I would leave and I would never come back.
Welcome to Poets Cafe. I'm host Lois P. Jones, and tonight's guest is Brian Turner, one of the most recognized poets living today, who has both participated and written on the war in poetry, collections, and memoir. His latest book, My Life as a Foreign Country, a memoir, has been called a humane, heartbreaking, and expertly crafted work of literature by Tim O'Brien. It's published by W.W. Norton and by Random House in the UK. We know Brian from, as mentioned, his two award-winning and groundbreaking collections of poetry, Hear Bullet and Phantom Noise. And Brian's poetry and essays have been published in the New York Times, National Geographic Poetry Daily. The list goes on and on. He was featured in the documentary film Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience, which was nominated for an Academy Award. He's also received an NEA Literature Fellowship in Poetry, the Amy Lowell Traveling Fellowship, and a number of other fellowships, including the Lannan Foundation. His work has appeared on National Public Radio, the BBC NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, Here and Now, and on Weekend America, among others. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
I'm sure one of the questions you always are asked is, you know, why did you join? And the section that you just read from the infantry helps to clarify some of the aspects of your decision. Your memoir is about questions you ask yourself and also some of the answers you discover in the process. And, of course, there's questions that remain unanswered as well. I wanted to mention Kathleen Berry. I don't know if you know who she is. She's the author of the book Unmaking War, Remaking Men. And that question came up to me as I read through this book that's so rich with your perceptions, your lyricism, and your experience. I wonder if we can unmake war and remake the man. And, you know, that's a big question,
sure,
I know.
Sure.
And I know you weren't looking to be a hero, and it was sort of a chance to have an experience and a connection to your past. Do you think we can dismantle the war machine and the soldier archetype?
It's a tricky business. It's such a large... How much time do we have?
I know. That's a huge question to come into. But it's something that, you know, through the centuries, mm-hmm. how it's been for men to serve mm-hmm. and serve in honor. And there's a dignity in defending one's country under oppression. And yet, we're sort of geared toward that, you know, little boys with their toys, their army toys and things. I don't know.
Sure. There are several threads in the book, but one of them is definitely centered around that question, why did I join and what led me to that mm-hmm. decision? Because on the surface, I've often over the years answered people with sort of a sketch of an answer saying, oh, I come from a long line of military tradition in my family.
Right.
But what does that mean? Right. So as I started writing the book, I tried to really answer that. And the answers are usually in small moments, like my grandfather sitting in the family home when I was seven. And in the 70s, there were often these sort of war movies on television. They were usually wars of genocide and colonialism and oppression. We called them Westerns. And, you know, so there'd be warfare, you know, screaming and shouting and rifles being fired. And I'd be watching in fascination. And then I would just register sometimes, but not too much, but it was more of a subconscious level that my grandfather never spoke during these times. And he would often walk outside to check in the, there was a tool shed. He would go check on his tools, which was a euphemism for, you know, having a few shots of right. something to drink so he could sort of get through the afternoon as he sat there listening to people screaming. I now look back and I can sense the layers that were in that moment that I didn't recognize, you know, Iwo Jima and Bougainville and Guam right. and the voices that he may have been hearing at that time and the memories that must have been dredged up, you know, or echoed in those moments. So this book doesn't answer the question fully for me, but it does come closer and closer sort of by circling through and sort of cycling through different parts of my own past and the family heritage that's been handed down to me. And one of the things that I've come to, and I hate to say it because it's a difficult thing to say, mm-hmm. As well as all the things that you've already sort of given it, the context you've given us, I would add that there's also maybe in parallel is one of the strands that's connected to this conversation, a kind of pathology mm-hmm. that's an inherited thing from one generation to another in many families and in our culture. And it's this idea that, you know, these people that we revere, we can't speak to them or understand them until we too go through this right. age-old journey or test, go through some kind of test of fire. And then if we survive it, we come back changed and maybe we know something about our inner metal. And there's definitely a pathology to it too, because many times we'll erect monuments, and mm-hmm. you can go from country to country. It's not just America. Mm-hmm. You know, in different countries, you'll see monuments to war, to their warriors and right. the people they've lost. And I love Sebastian Junger, one of the ideas he'd suggest at one point, that maybe there could be a monument to all the civilians lost in war. And it'd be very healthy for someone like myself and other veterans even to have a space like that to go to kind of have a quiet moment with that sort of meditation, thinking about the wide lens of loss.
That's a great idea. I'm thinking about also the idea of conversation and how you said that your grandfather couldn't really talk about the war, and that's pretty common. A friend of mine whose father was in one of the death camps in World War II, he was one of the Americans on site, you know, freeing them and seeing their starving bodies and, you know, their situation. And he just could never talk about it. And in your memoir, you mentioned how a lot of this is just, you know, you're taught as a soldier mm-hmm. to kind of button all that stuff up. And don't you think that conversation is so important? And not only to pass down in generation to generation, mm-hmm. but also for the health of the individual to mm-hmm. be able to exercise some of the demons that they come home with.
Sure. Even in the military, even in a kind of Machiavellian sense, just of terms of keeping the machine working and humming along, you know, like in terms of having a as healthy a possible sort of military force. When you train as a soldier or as a service member, you know, soldiers oftentimes sort of army-centric, but service members, when they train, they'll do a field exercise where they practice war or practice some event or exercise. Or when they go to war and they might be in a there's a mission that takes place and they come back. In either case, when they come back, normally what they do is an after-action review, and they sort of talk about all the things that happened and how they could improve upon those things.
Mm-hmm.
In a larger scale way, when they come back from major exercises, they'll lay out all their equipment and do an inventory, and they'll see what's broken or what's missing, and then they'll replace them and fix them, those things. And
mm-hmm.
then they'll look at their bodies, and they'll do a physical test, say, on, you know, once they've come home, and they'll see that maybe their run score is lower, or their, so they'll assess their bodies in a similar way, what's fixed, what's broken, and then they'll try to improve upon that.
Mm-hmm.
But the human being that runs all of these things, all of the apparatus of war, the apparatus of military service, that's oftentimes sort of lighted over. And the military community has been working, and I think the larger community in some ways has been trying to help soldiers and veterans and to assess themselves and try to find a way to become healthier in their lives,
mm-hmm.
Mentally. But the presence of John Wayne is still in the culture,
right.
Both the larger culture and the military culture, and it's hard to sort of get those two. The John Wayne sort of presence of suck it up and drive on and put in a box and bury
right.
it and don't, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then this other side that recognizes that, hey, maybe there were some difficult things that we just went through, and we need to kind of have a sense of this as we move forward, whether we stay in service or we don't. It'll be healthier for those serving next to each other, and it'll be healthier for the wider culture when they sort of get out of uniform and become Brian again or whoever they might be.
Right.
Yeah.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Poets Cafe. I'm host Lois P. Jones, and we're here with our fine guest, Brian Turner. He's talking about his memoir, My Life as a Foreign Country. And we're talking about, of course, the elements of war. What do you think is the difference? You know, you talk about your grandfather in the Battle of Meuse-Argonne and the subsequent wars, the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, of course, the previous war, World War II. There is a need to raise the public consciousness of the war experience, and that is done brilliantly in your memoir. How can we, as a nation, balance these latent wars that seem so motivated by corporate greed to some of the wars of the past?
I'm not really sure if I'm capable of doing that. I mean, I struggle with trying to recognize the lineage and then to see what new lessons we're learning with each conflict we've been a part of. I'm honored to be here today and to be a part of this book and to try to be a part of a larger conversation.
Right.
We would be well served if we could find ways to bring the Iraqi people and Afghan people into the conversation,
yeah.
to be able to hear them, because I think I could learn much more about the war that I served in if I listened. For example, in the next 10 to 20 years, as children who survived find ways to write their poems and stories and have conversations about these things, I'll learn a very different war, I think, than the one that I experienced.
Right.
And that might help us to understand. I mean, I guess going back in history, you know, in Afghanistan, for example, the first Afghan war was in, I believe, 1839 to 1842.
Mm-hmm.
The second was in the 1870s, and the other one is right around the eve of World War I. And there are parts of the world where Britain and the United States have had an ongoing conversation, very difficult conversation, very painful and tragic one. And after a while, it may not seem to the folks living there where, you know, in oral tradition, when you're just passing down stories, oh, they were here when my great-grandfather was here, they're my great-grandmother, they were here when my mother was born, they were here when my uncle was, you know, after a while, it doesn't seem as if one particular thing is happening, like maybe attacking the terrorist camps in the northern part of Afghanistan. It might start to feel like imperialism,
mm-hmm.
colonialism,
right.
just a continued generational conversation. How do we undo that?
Right.
You know, it seems to me, and this is broadening out probably beyond my ability to really sort of effectively communicate, but I struggle with it because from my own experience in my family, the people I love and revere to this day, and I still would hope that I could rise to be like half the man that some of them. I'm speaking pure masculinity here. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. another book I need to write about women in my life and all the things I've learned, and both good and bad, you know, and their connections to war and combat and conflict. There's a pathology, as I mentioned, that's connected, inherited, and passed down that leads, I think, many to join. They may be couched in very different terms, of course, you know, a pride of military service and serving your country and trying to defend the values of the country. There may be a different language around it, but some of the net effect is about the same. There's trauma at the end of it, and there are people whose names we may never learn how to even pronounce. And that works really well with the corporate structure in America because as a corporate structure, you know, they've got the latest, most amazing lethal machines that are on the market, and we get to see snippets of them. And we get to see them a bit in action, even though there's a lot of secrecy around them. But the amazing, phenomenal technological advances in military hardware that were in the last conflict, those are outmoded. So we can sell them now.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes war by war. We're selling the last generation product. You know, and the military-industrial complex in this country, you know, I know your listeners are well-versed in those dynamics. So the two of them go well hand in hand. With the pride of military service in America can oftentimes feed into a corporate need.
Right. But and that's the difficulty, because how can we as a nation embrace the current support of our military when we know that it's layered with these other dynamics? And, of course, you have many versions of this. People think that we should be in there. People think we shouldn't be in there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the perpetual machine goes on.
I hope you don't mind me just jumping
in. No, go ahead.
I'm trying to work like on a human-to-human level. So most of my poems and stories have to do – I don't really get into the conceptual too often in the large – I feel like that's – my work is in the field of – in that larger field. But more of the, I think we can learn from individual human stories. So in a similar way, when I was in Iraq, for example, and I don't know if the people who helped me in this way, whether they believed that we should be doing the things we're doing or not, but there was a thing called booksforsoldiers.com, which I'm not connected to.
Mm-hmm.
I just, I heard about it when I was there. And I remember I went on, and there are these things called morale, welfare, and recreation tents and or services. So in some of the bases in Iraq, for example, and I'm sure in Afghanistan, there are sometimes internet stations where you can email home, maybe a phone booth where you could call someone, and other things. But among them, there's sometimes, as I found near north of Baghdad one time, in the back of the tent, sort of the shadowy darkness, there was these lazy Susans with books in them, paperbacks. And there were boxes and boxes of books stacked to the ceiling. And as I rifled through them and took the boxes and, you know, unstacked the boxes to try to find, it was, and I'm not making this up, it was box after box of Harlequin romances, you know, and I didn't have like a bathtub with some suds and a glass of wine, so it didn't quite, you know, it didn't work with
bizarre.
Fabio on the cover, you know, it wasn't really what I was looking for, and so I could go to booksforsoldiers.com, and what you could do is put in an author's name or a subject, like mystery or crime or something, and I put Iraqi cuisine, and about 3 weeks later, and the beauty of this is that it was also done anonymously on my end. So I was able to get a book from someone anonymously in America. So when I came back with a polarized country, I still felt as if there were people that cared enough to send me a book.
Right.
Which was very moving, very powerful.
Sure. Yeah. If you're just tuned in, you're listening to Poets Cafe. I'm host Lois P. Jones with our guest Brian Turner. And he's talking about his heartbreaking, wonderful book, My Life as a Foreign Country, a memoir. Let's get back to your book, if we can. And one of the things you talked about is trying to understand the war somewhat also from the Iraqi viewpoint. And you've written a couple of sequences on that. One of them is very haunting about the Iraqi woman.
That's section 16.
Yes.
60 years later, in 2004, could the young Iraqi woman preparing herself in the far room of the house feel as that kamikaze felt that day he walked toward his plane, before his morning shifted into a pitched dive from blue to blue, his life driven into the metal-clad surface of the ship's flight deck, his body transformed from water to fire to smoke? She stares a moment into a handheld mirror. Perhaps she does this because there is a deep and abiding human need to fully recognize all that the world will soon lose. A kind of inward grieving, maybe. even as the voices in the next room call out to her to don the vest they've worked through the night to create, even as a languid old cat stretches on the floor beside her feet, a droplet of water swelling on the underside of the faucet's lip. And when she leans in close to study the water, another version of herself bends its shadowy form in the fluid's convex lens, her legs disappearing beneath her, arms spreading outward, as if practicing the motion, her fingertips and palms already deep within the vanishing to come.
It's amazing. Beautifully wrought. And what precedes that in the book is a section where you talk about the kamikaze pilot and the night before his mission and then the day of the mission.
And the struggle with giving up a life and doing something for a larger cause and giving one's life fully to this moment and that's waiting for them, seemingly right ahead of them the next day or that part of the day, so few hours left, so few moments left. It was difficult because, to try to think in the mind, and I've heard this said by many, that, it's incomprehensible to understand a suicide bomber. But I feel that's part of the job of writers and thinkers and all of us is to try to understand what is it that would lead someone to feel that passionately about something.
Yes. Well, that's what we're dealing with.
Right.
All of these ISIS people and this extreme fundamentalism. That section brought to mind, there's a fellow named Harada who was a kamikaze pilot in World War II. Mm. Very old guy, one of the last living pilots around. And there's a move now to beef up, the prime minister is trying to beef up the military because two of the journalists in Japan were murdered by the ISIS people.
Right.
And his mission is to remind, because Japan is a pacifist country.
Right. It's in their constitution.
It's in their constitution. Yeah. And people are forgetting, why that happened. So he goes to children's, to schools and things like that, and he tells them, don't join. This is what it was like. This is what it felt like to look in the eyes of a man and kill him,
I spent, I was very fortunate as part of the U.S.-Japan Friendship Commission. They send 5 American artists each year to Japan in connection with an organization there. It's called the Bunkacho. With the NEA here, they partner to send choreographers, artists, landscape designers, musicians, writers.
Fantastic.
So I was able to go there. My wife and I, she's also a writer, and we went and spent 3 months there. It was far too short a time, but such a beautiful country, and part of my project there was to study, because I'm fascinated with Japanese culture in many ways, but among them is this idea of martial valor and the samurai ethos, the warrior ethos, centuries in development, and such a, the warrior caste is part of a major section of their sort of their public thought and their, and one of the identities of a role that you might aspire to in Japanese life throughout the century. So
that's
how
right.
did they
how
so
did they
quickly
mute that?
Right and change and what? So I think there's a great lesson to be learned there. I know is born from great and tremendous loss and tragedy within their culture, but at the same time there's a deep a deep well of a path towards peace.
Right.
And I try to learn a lot from
that. That's excellent.
I think there's many years that I need to spend listening to Japanese people and trying to learn from that history and that shift and that pivot.
Because we have this dichotomy. I don't know all the reasons, of course, that you joined.
Most people joined for socioeconomic reasons.
Okay.
Maybe they never had a car
and that's
with
a
new
big
car
reason
smell.
Too, right?
Yeah. And after 9/11, there was a spike, and I could see people coming in who wanted to fight, wanted to defend the country, and for a wide variety of reasons sort of centered around that sort of process.
Right.
And then the economy tanked again, and then it shifted back to an economic, primarily in the enlisted ranks. I'm not talking about the officer corps.
Right.
But vast majority of people serve are mostly in the enlisted ranks,
Wow, we're running down out of time.
Oh, no.
We're just getting warmed up here.
It's a big, beautiful world. So much work that needs to be done.
Could you take us out with the ghost section, if you'd like?
Mosul.
Yeah, Mosul.
Mosul is inside me. All of its buildings, all of its smoke and pollution. It's 1.7 million people. The university district and the bridges over the winding river. Barber shops and ice trucks and sheep grazing in the ruins of Nineveh. Minarets. water buffalo in the eucalyptus groves where the rotting uniforms of Saddam's military continued to disappear, the dead Canadians out by the television station, the Kurdish Peshmerga standing guard behind sandbagged machine gun emplacements stationed around the regional political office, old men staring from the automotive shops, the bird-like bodies of their grandchildren chasing after us through the neighborhoods, the ghosts rising from the mist along the river, the slow-moving ghosts in the streets and alleys of Mosul, the many ghosts returning to their homes each night to sleep with the ones they love. Dead tanks rust in a graveyard of metal beyond the outskirts of the city, like skeletons in a field. They remind me of images of German and French and British soldiers left on the battlefields of the First World War, their jawbones unhinged, small tufts of hair clinging to the curvature of the skull, the way sawgrass clings to the dunes by the sea, wind blowing through them as through a flute.
This is Lois P. Jones, and my guest has been Brian Turner. Thank you for coming in, Brian.
Oh, it's an honor. I wish we had days.
I know.
Thank you so much.
There'll be another time. Look for the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK, Pacifica Radio, for all of Southern California and beyond.